David Lane studies tattoos, and the ISU professor has a new book on how this apprentice-based art form builds consistency and tradition. The very popular industry has some interesting quirks. Hear about the sociology of tattooists and their values just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington and Normal police departments have significant vacancies in the ranks, and it's not just them. It's a state and national issue.
Some agencies have had to pretty significantly modify their staffing models, force 12-hour shifts, do things like that. We're certainly not at that point yet.
Normal PD has 11 vacancies. Last year, there were three. And many Americans have no knowledge of the richness and variety of the many Latino cultures. It's Latinx and Hispanic Heritage Month. Those stories and a Bloomington Normal news update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Normal Police Department has a staff shortage, just like the rest of the economy. The available police workforce is down 20% from a full staff of 84. There are some officers in training, so the situation will improve, but Chief Rick Bleichner says it is a historic number of vacancies. Bleichner says for the first time, Normal will recruit from other police agencies.
We have not done that before. We have not had a lateral hiring program. I mean, any candidates previously would have to go through the full process. But our hope is that we would then be able to incentivize individuals with full-time police experience certified in Illinois. They would then come on at our police department. They would start basically their seniority from day one. But our hope is that they would start then and get plugged in at a higher pay rate based on their prior experience. Right there, it gives us some benefit because we don't have to send someone to the police academy. So we kind of save 3.5 months there. We can then plug them into our field training program and, you know, start with that.
Some police agencies who make a practice of hiring from other agencies have had mixed luck with that because they don't always have access to the full disciplinary records, and there is a higher risk of getting somebody who is not the optimum candidate or a good performer than there is if you just hire them initially and make them go through the training process. How do you plan to mitigate that risk?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're aware of. We would lean on our background investigators. It's very important for them as they go through that process. There's things to certainly look for in individuals' personnel files. And although under state law, I mean, things may be expunged for the purposes of discipline, they don't go away. You can't just get rid of them and shred them under Illinois law and federal law. So we would certainly look back on those and try and obtain an accurate history of what the individual's performance and their past patterns have been. Plus, moving forward, in Illinois, with the it's been in place since 2015, but as the Police Officers Decertification Act, which was even strengthened more with the Safety Act that passed in July. So there's certain things now that just won't be able to be deleted or removed from files. They have to be retained.
So counting the people who have retired and that you have not yet replaced, and counting the people who are in training and not available to you for street duty, you are, in fact, down 17.
Well, and out of the 11 vacancies, there are 5 of those that are from what I would consider specialty divisions that are not on patrol. And so those go unfilled right now at this point. Those would be from our detective division, our vice unit, our school resource officer program, things like that. We certainly plan on staffing those. But we have not taken away from the patrol staffing or by hiring or filling those positions, if you will, because we're conscious of the need that we have on patrol.
That's still work that's not getting done. So how are you covering for these 17 people?
Well, it's like we are when any other time. I mean, we have hire backs that we do. We pull from our existing staffing, and that means sometimes individuals will have to, if we don't have adequate staffing at that time, when we hire back, we have to pay additional and overtime and things like that.
So how complex is trying to cover those bases?
We certainly are cognizant of adding staff, but you also can't grow or put those people back too quickly because we only have so many people that we can do adequate training. And if we were to go away from that and bring people on too quickly, then we would probably create other issues downstream.
Many agencies say they are experiencing smaller initial applicant pools than any time that they can recall. What are you experiencing?
We certainly are seeing fewer numbers as well. I think our last process that we did in the spring. I think we had close to 100 applicants, and right now I think we just closed our applicants yesterday, and we have around 80, so it's down.
What about the general quality of that pool?
Part of it is when you start with a smaller number, you end up with a smaller number that when you get to that hiring point. So there's some downsides to that, I guess, because you're all, it seems like you're regularly in a hiring process. But the upside of that is that, you know, you've got a fresh pool. You've got candidates who want to be employed here. And if you have vacancies, it's very easy to move them into those. Whereas previously when we did that, we may hire two people, you know, in September. We may hire two people in January. Well, half of the people that are on that particular list have been hired elsewhere and are no longer available. That's one of the benefits I can see, is that our hiring pool is more current. So I think that's, you know, it's a downside, obviously. It'd be nice to be able to only have to test once every couple of years, but that's not the environment we're in right now.
So where's this going? How do you counter the current trend?
Well, I mean, I think it's got to be twofold. We have to look for ways in which we can retain all the employees that we have, whether it's wellness, whether it's some other types of incentives, whether it is programs or things like that, building resiliency. And then we have to look at, you know, try and be creative and how can we better, you know, recruit individuals, because we can't do anything about, you know, if there are people that are upset or concerned about the state of policing, or the, you know, with some changes in mandates, some changes in certification processes, some changes in the statutes. Those are things that are out of our control. As law enforcement, I mean, we're tasked with following the laws, knowing the laws, applying them equally and fairly. And then our goal now is to try and figure out how can we craft a way to where we can recruit and bring in additional people that we need to get our workforce back up to where it needs to be. I think that it's pretty common across the state. When I talk with my counterparts in other municipalities, that's the biggest concern for them, and the biggest complaint is staffing. Some agencies have had to pretty significantly modify their staffing models, force 12-hour shifts, do things like that. We're certainly not at that point yet, but that's a pretty common theme, and it's not just Illinois. I mean, it's across the country. Individuals, you know, or chiefs and sheriffs are talking about how their workforce is leaving to go to the private sector and do other things.
Since this is a national issue, is there a consensus in the law enforcement community on why?
I think it's kind of twofold. Back in the late, you know, mid to late 90s, when the private sector was really booming, it was difficult to recruit people in law enforcement back then. Now, I think it's a combination of things. There's a lot of full-time, good-paying jobs in the private sector that are unfilled right now. Companies are looking for good people. They're paying bonuses or incentives to hire good quality people. The other part is, I think there's obviously been a lot of the national rhetoric. A lot of attention has been drawn to police, use of force, appropriate funding levels for police, some of the defund movement that's been going. And I think that just kind of the continual drumbeat of those types of things probably wears on people. Then they look to go elsewhere. And that's not just to law enforcement. I mean, it's that way towards government in general. We're a divided country on a lot of issues. A lot of those things get focused on government for doing certain things, for not doing certain things. And so I think that in general, that there's a lot more criticism or you know, oversight and expectations for government employees in general than there ever has been.
That's Rick Bleichner, the police chief in Normal. Bloomington police are also down a significant number of officers, but proportionally less than normal. The McLean County Sheriff's Department is at full staff, but Sheriff John Sandage says they have had more attrition than usual because deputies are leaving for larger agencies that pay more and have more opportunities for advancement.
By now, you've heard a lot about Fall Fund Drive.
Now, if you haven't already donated,
I'm WGLT financial contributor Sharon Shaw from Bloomington.
Luckily, joining the contribution right now,
we're adding more fans to come over to right now.
There's only one thing left to say. This fund drive is coming up short. If more WGLT listeners don't step up soon, like in the next day or two soon, we're going to face some tough choices about what we cover and what our schedule looks like. Only a few hours left to give. Contribute now at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Latinx and Hispanic Heritage Month. It's a national month-long celebration through October 15th dedicated to honoring the culture, history, and experiences of Hispanics and Latinoxes in the United States. While Latinx Month is a key point in the year to celebrate Latinos, individuals can be brought to a better understanding of the richness of Latinx culture year-round. WGLT student reporter Jordan Mead speaks with several Latinx community members about why this recognition is important to them.
According to 2020 data from Pew Research, the Hispanic population makes up approximately 19% of the U.S. population. The overall U.S. population increased by over 22 million between 2010 and 2020. Hispanics made up 51% of that growth. The number of Hispanics and Latinos in the U.S. is rising faster than other groups. This increase in Latinos has brought many parts of Latin America into United States culture through music, food, dancing, Spanish language, and even media attention. Yet, it is not uncommon for many Hispanics and Latinos to face a multitude of challenges living in the United States, regardless of immigration status. In July, federal judge Andrew Hannon blocked thousands of deferred action for childhood arrivals applicants from receiving approval for DACA status, affecting thousands. Currently, the Biden administration supports the DACA program. Illinois State University's director of the Latin American and Latino Studies program is Maura Toro-Morn. She came to the United States in the 80s. Toro-Morn says her experiences lead her to believe one of the most difficult challenges for Latinos is the lack of immigration reform.
We have so many young people that are so eager to become part of American society, to work, to share their art, their music, their poetry, their writings, their educational experiences. And now we have a segment of our community that is actually in a permanent hold. You have liminal legality.
Toro-Morn says Latinos feel rejected and not valued for their global contributions. Latinx and Hispanic Heritage Month does not solve these challenges, but it does try to get people to recognize the impact of slavery, colonialism, modern-day racism, displacement, and fear that centuries of Latinos have endured. And the occasion celebrates the success and contributions of Latinos in the United States. Michelle Mancias is an assistant vice president and counsel for State Farm. Mancias says she is proud of her Mexican-American heritage.
It's nice to be able to recognize one's cultural identity and to have others recognize it and talk about it freely. It's great to have pride in one's ancestry and one's ethnicity, so I'm glad that there's a lot of recognition and the ability to be proud of where you come from, where your ancestors come from.
Mancias says one of the beautiful things about Latinx culture is there is no one single culture.
There's some sort of common themes, but I think like the Afro-Latino experience could be very different than, you know, a blonde, blue-eyed person who has Argentinian roots or Spanish roots, for example. So it's easy, I think, for people to paint with a broad brush and not really recognize the richness of the Hispanic and Latino society and community as a whole.
To be brought to a better understanding of the richness of Latinx culture, people must not base their ideas of Latinos from stereotypes. That's according to Martha Saldana, administrative assistant and food pantry director at the Western Avenue Community Center.
In general, people need to give themselves the opportunity to grow through the view of the cultural vision of all the like-minded people that they share with. Although we are a minority, we are a good amount.
For Latinos in the United States, Saldana says to value oneself and one's heritage, you have to be proud of where you are from and of your traditions.
You have to know where you come from and where you are, value where you are, and of course, form your new vision of the world and your culture to understand today the society that was not necessarily your parents is yours today.
In a nation where many individuals don't speak Spanish, building both community and networking opportunities can be a difficult challenge. Saldana says to know and study one's roots and family origin makes expressing one's identity a more positive experience. Saldana and Socorro Alvarez, the Hispanic Outreach Director at the Western Avenue Community Center, say they feel it is important to share traditions promoting Latinidad, the shared cultures of Latinos in the United States. Alvarez says in adapting cultural aspects of the United States, especially for those not born in the U.S., it's fundamental to continue living out Latinidad. The traditions surrounding family, music, food, language, and more are to be preserved, not only for the Latinx community, but to build deeper connections between Latinos and non-Latinos. As the Latino share of the U.S. population continues to increase, ISU's Maura Doramorn says society must recognize that Latinos and non-Latinos are both working towards the same goal of sustaining themselves.
To start with that recognition of that humanity, right? We are different, but we're not less than. We speak a different language, but we can still communicate. Just because I may not be able to speak English properly, it doesn't mean that I am deficient. It means we have to find a way to communicate.
So, Latinos and non-Latinos must support one another. Doramorn says non-Latinos can gain a stronger understanding of the richness of the culture by maintaining an open mind and listening to the perspectives of Latinos within their communities. She says different backgrounds, traditions, and languages do not need to prevent connections and the spread of Latinidad throughout the United States. I'm Jordan Mead.
This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. I'm Sarah Nardi with Jennifer Armstrong as we continue the Fall Fun Drive. We've been at this fun drive for a week now, and we're down to the final days, but we need a lot more listeners to step up and help us push this fun drive to our $75,000 goal. Contribute now, whatever you can, at WGLT.org.
Donors tell us all of the time one of the many things they love about WGLT is that we're different from other local media outlets. One way we're different is shows like Sound Ideas. We're able to bring you this show each weekday full of local news because we're investing more, not less, in reporting stories about Bloomington Normal.
Our newsroom is growing when a lot of other media outlets are shrinking. As a nonprofit media organization, every dollar we raise is invested right back into this station. Now it's your turn to invest in us. Renew your support or make your first contribution. Support community-powered and community-focused media with a donation at WGLT.org.
Local news matters. We're betting you agree since you're listening to Sound Ideas right now. The WGLT newsroom makes choices every day about what we cover and what we don't. Oftentimes, the newsroom makes those decisions based on resources. Do we have enough reporters to cover that event?
Financial contributions make those decisions easier by helping to fund our growing team of reporters, part-time correspondents, and student journalists. Together, those contributions allow WGLT to deliver you all the news you need to make decisions for yourself, your family, and your community. We're able to remain locally focused and independent in our news coverage because of people like you who contribute. Your financial support during the Fall Fun Drive tells us you care about having your favorite NPR programs on the air, a local newsroom, and shows like Sound Ideas. Donate now to fund it all at WGLT.org.
On our website, you can renew your annual support, make an additional gift, or make that very cool first donation. It only takes 2 minutes to donate. Get it done today, don't wait, and help push this fund drive goal into the final hours over the finish line. Support your community-powered public media at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charles Schlenker. In his new book, ISU professor David Lane explores the world of tattooing from the artist's point of view. And the other end of the needle, continuity and change among tattoo workers, Lane examines the peculiar codes and conventions that link artists to their traditions. Lane tells Sarah Nardi he's had a lifelong interest in tattoos.
I grew up with punk rock and skateboarding. So I saw a lot of tattooed bodies as a kid. And then it turns out that I started getting tattooed. And in that process, I spent a lot of time learning about tattoos, which also meant spending a lot of time in tattoo shops. So whether I was getting tattooed or not, I was there. And something struck me of like, how do you do this job?
And you point out that tattoo artists don't go to school to learn how to do tattoos. There's no real formal education process, no certificates. It really kind of exists outside the realm of traditional education. And so there's a lot of self-regulation that occurs.
Yeah, and it occurs because they don't have like strong associations or anything. So I'm a sociologist. We've got all these sociological professional associations. Now they're not going to give me like legal help or something, but in tattooing, they really don't have any of that. And if you look at other professions like the American Medical Association, the APA with psychiatry, I mean, they have strong associations that vie for control and ownership. And for some reason, tattooing has avoided that.
The way you describe it almost makes me think of tattoo artists like a guild. They're protecting their own traditions, passing them down through apprentices outside of any sort of formalized structure, but still working collectively.
And they're not, but yet they still hone in on this same value set. So it's not like they all completely agree, but yet it's still there. And obviously I've written this work and we're sitting here in 2021 and I'm looking back thinking there are parts of this that have changed since then. You know, with some of the control they once had, because it is so open, they've lost some of that, and that newer people are moving into this occupation without following those pathways.
And how does that affect the broader culture?
I mean, there's what I've seen, and this is rumblings from people of like, oh, we don't want gatekeepers in tattooing. And I'm kind of sitting here, and maybe I have a really advantaged position, but I'm like, yeah, I want a gatekeeper in the medical profession. Like, yeah, I want a gatekeeper who knows what they're doing before they start putting needles into people's bodies. That's probably a good thing. But yeah, there's this whole push, and part of it is probably tied to the fact that tattooing has become so popular. Now, more people are like, hey, I can make money off of this. But the older networks are still there, and those that old guard is still like, that's not the way to do it.
Is part of what's going on there the fact that it's crept into popular culture to such a degree, you know, on, you know, there's reality shows about people working in tattoo shops, that's kind of contributed to a dilution of the collective values that were being held one way or another?
Yeah, it gets pumped into people's living rooms and basements, right? I have a whole, part of a chapter on that tattooists generally were pretty angry about those shows. Because they were really, I shouldn't say really, they were unrealistic narratives of what happens in a tattoo shop.
So what's it really like in a tattoo shop?
I don't know. I mean, some of the shops I've been in, like, there's one person I hang out with now and I go get tattooed from, and he only lets one person in. And this was pre-COVID as well, but like, he's just burning some incense, listening to music, tattooing, doing things at his own pace. So like the logic of time versus money that we see in contemporary capitalism isn't there.
Is that intentional? Because, I mean, it's easy to think of tattoos existing outside of things in so many ways. Did it intentionally, as an industry, develop kind of counter to traditional modes of capitalism?
I think it's within a capitalist system, but it's a group of people who are working with a different set of values. So if anything, I wouldn't say it's a resistance so much as they're resilient in that they've carved out a niche to avoid some of those threats that we see to other occupations.
That was ISU Professor David Lane, who wrote the book The Other End of the Needle. He spoke with Sarah Nardi. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.